The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Science can measure the intensity of an earthquake or a tropical cyclone. It can record wind speed and storm surge. But catastrophic disasters are not caused by nature alone. The extent of the devastation is also tied to social factors that are much harder to measure or calculate. 10 years after Hurricane Katrina slammed into the Gulf Coast and became the most expensive and one of the deadliest hurricanes in American history, a new book seeks to understand the socioeconomic factors behind the world's worst natural disasters. John Mutter is a geophysicist and professor at Columbia University, where he teaches environmental science and public affairs. His new book is called The Disaster Profiteers: How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Even Poorer. And John Mutter, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, so in the opening of your book, you write that Hurricane Katrina was not an especially intense storm, which is not how we remember, certainly, the devastating aftermath. So what makes you say that?
That's a measure in terms of its strength on the Saffir-Simpson scale. So as it approached in the Gulf of Mexico, it got as large as Category 5, but by the time it made landfall, it had dropped to a Category 3. And I think before it got to Lake Pontchartrain, it was about a Category 2, which is not trivial given the wind speeds, but it's far from being at the top end of the possible strength of a hurricane. Yet, as you say, its mortality effect, its social outcomes far exceeded what you'd expect for a hurricane of that physical magnitude.
So it wasn't the storm itself. It was when the levees broke, when the city
Correct.
Was flooded. City of New Orleans
Right.
certainly was flooded. So you can get accurate measurements of the force of the storm. But how about these other intangibles, the social forces, media coverage? How can you look at those from a scientific measurable point of view?
It's not as easy. So you have to sort of try a modeling exercise and suggest, you know, okay, I've got a Category 3 hurricane and it's approaching Houston. What might I expect? Is there a strong government that would have the institutions capable of evacuating people? That would help save lives. But then if you think, well, it's going to ruin certain facilities that have economic importance to Houston, do they have the institutions to recover? A lot of it's in the recovery. A lot of it is less to do with how much you lose and more to do with how quickly you can recover what you've lost.
You write about the link between geography and poverty in New Orleans, but also in Haiti, where there was an terrible, devastating earthquake, in Myanmar, where a cyclone killed more than 100,000 people, all of which suffered these, you know, catastrophic natural disasters in the past 10 years. How did economic segregation in these places make these disasters, in your opinion, worse than they would have been otherwise?
Yeah, well, you can think of any of those places. The poor in New Orleans are geographically segregated as well as economically segregated. If you take a trip to New Orleans, go to the French Quarter, go to the casinos, look at the river, you'd never know those places existed. You don't even drive past them on the way in from the airport. You would have to consciously get in a car, get a map, figure out where the lower Ninth Ward is, and go there. And that, it's not exactly deliberate, but it's a geography that's evolved over time. So the wealthier people live in certain areas that stayed relatively dry, and the poorer people live in low, crowded areas, very poor facilities, very poor communications, a great deal of mistrust of the government. So if you don't trust the government and the government says, get out of town, you're likely not to do it because you've had no reason in the past to do what the government has said, to expect the government to fulfill on promises, which, of course, is what happened.
Well, those kind of conditions existed before the storm. So how does it contribute to a deepening chasm in the aftermath of these disasters?
So in a simple way, to begin with, of course, the poor are less able to cope. They have no savings. They're extremely unlikely to have anything insured. And if they lose their job because where they were employed has been destroyed, their opportunity to find another one is very limited. But if you're part of the wealthy elite, almost by accident, your house, which is larger and better built, not necessarily built with the notion that it's going to be earthquake-proof, but merely because it's made out of better materials, it's new, you've got all the latest things, it's going to be stronger, not by design, but almost by accident. So the survival rate of well-built buildings owned by the elite are going to be higher than the survival rate of buildings owned by the poor. And then the ability of the wealthy to recover is much better than the ability of the poor to recover. So the wealthy get back quickly, even though on paper they may seem to have lost more because their capital assets would have a larger value, while a poor person may seem to have lost little, yet a house to a poor person means as much as one does to a wealthy person, yet getting back to the position of where they were before is much harder, and they frequently don't return to the position they were before.
We're speaking with John Mutter. He's a geophysicist and professor at Columbia, where he teaches environmental science and public affairs. He's got a new book called The Disaster Profiteers, How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Even Poorer. What can you tell us, actually, about the demographic and socioeconomic shift in New Orleans? Before Katrina, it was a predominantly African-American city. It is not now.
The ratio has changed. It is still predominantly African American, in as much as they occupy a greater percentage, but there's been about a 20% drop in the African American population in New Orleans, primarily because people have not been able to return. Their homes have been completely destroyed, the value of which, even if they had them insured, was quite low. So even if you could cash in on your insurance payout was far less than what it would cost you to construct a new house. And the government there has been very discouraging of rebuilding in the devastated areas. And it's been somewhat gentrified. Some of the black areas are turning gray, I saw written in just a little while ago, meaning that there's a sort of white sort of gentrification of previously black areas, which you see all over cities in the U.S., like the one I'm sitting in right now, New York.
Was it necessarily true that the areas worst hit by Katrina were indeed predominantly African-American neighborhoods?
There's two places that were really badly hit, and one was relatively wealthy and the other was relatively poor. So Lakeview, which is a relatively wealthy area, I don't mean very, very wealthy, but certainly middle class to a little bit above that, and the lower ninth and around Treme, etc., were flooded to approximately the same depth. Okay, so it came up just as high in both places. The difference is in the ability to respond, to get back on your feet. And if you look at the repopulation data from Lakeview, many, many more people have returned than have returned to the lower ninth. So the damage was not so very different, although the breach in the industrial canal caused a great deal of damage in the lower ninth, and there was nothing exactly equivalent in Lakeview, but the depth of flooding was the same. As I've tried to emphasize in the book, it's how you do afterwards that really matters.
Who are these profiteers in the title of your book? From a purely financial perspective, which industries and businesses do profit when a disaster like Katrina strikes?
So immediately, of course, there's the rebuilding phase. And it's not right, really, to call the people who are called in to help rebuild certain critical structures profiteers. They're doing it because they've been asked to do it. In too many occasions, there are no-bid contracts because people will say, we have to do this quickly, you know, as quick as we can. And people can charge whatever they like. There's very little oversight, so the work done in reconstruction is not especially good. Sometimes, okay, I don't want to condemn everybody. But that should be short-term, right? You get a building boom, then that fades away. That won't necessarily help the local people because local industries have been devastated. So companies in, you know, Virginia and Texas and wherever benefit from the rebuilding in New Orleans, not so much companies in New Orleans. Okay, but that's short term. But what you see is that a sort of elite that forms around government and government-connected industries will try to reshape the social geography of a place. And it's not necessarily New Orleans. They'll say, well, look at this part of New Orleans. It's poor. It's black. The crime rate is very high. So, in effect, the storm did a slum clearing that the city government couldn't do, you know, without something like that happening. It couldn't do it by vote. It couldn't, there'd be too many protests if they just cleared that, you know, by their own desire. And that happens in many, many places.
So what kind of institutional changes do you think could be made that might lessen the damage from natural disasters on the poor? I mean, where do you even begin?
I think the problem really is that there's very, very little oversight other than on things like, well, do you have a proper insurance claim? Where is the title to your house? Maybe you shouldn't move back here, that sort of thing. And there's very little oversight on what happens with social inequality. There's very little in government, federal and state, that says, I can't let this disadvantage the poor. It's almost like, you know, we have Medicaid for poor people, you know, so that and Obamacare, so that, you know, the poor aren't disadvantaged. But when something catastrophic happens, there's no similar regulatory safety net that helps the poor. The insurance industry helps the well-to-do. But there's very little for poor people, and it seems
FEMA.
Like there should be a way to do this.
Not FEMA?
Oh, FEMA was way too late. FEMA's emergency management, not post-emergency management.
So especially in the climate that we are living in now, where there's a mistrust of government handling mm-hmm. of things like what happened in New Orleans and the deep water disaster afterwards. So where do you begin there in New Orleans specifically?
Oh, first, it is part of city government. It takes commitment on the part of city officials to do this. And the other thing is that you really need to be willing to involve everybody and have everybody have their say. Too often it comes down to a small connected elite who are looking after their own interests and not the interests of the entire population. So a restructuring of the way decisions of that sort are made would in the beginning be very helpful.
Well, John Mutter, thank you for speaking with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
John Mutter, he of Columbia University. His new book is called The Disaster Profiteers, How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Even Poorer. You can find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Just before the break, we heard about how disproportionately Katrina hit New Orleans' poor populations. Now to a story of the long slog to recovery for the Circle Food Store in the city's 7th Ward. The store is thought to be New Orleans' first African-American owned and operated grocery. It started as an open-air farmer's market in 1919 and became a full food store in 1938, serving customers for decades until it was flooded after the levees broke following Hurricane Katrina. In a city where making groceries, local parlance for food shopping, is an integral part of its social and foodie culture, the community tried for more than 8 years to bring the store back to life. But their efforts were unsuccessful. That is, until last year. Lane Kaplan-Levinson from WWNO in New Orleans visited the neighborhood that surrounds the historic grocery store just before it reopened back in January of 2014.
Dwayne Boudreau has owned Circle Foods since 1993. He's been trying to restore the building since it flooded in Hurricane Katrina. Dwayne knew he wanted to bring back Circle Foods, but for a while had no resources or backing from the city to do so.
I started talking and entertaining ideas of leasing a place. A few different companies, some chain stores showed up. And every time I met, I didn't tell anybody, but the whole community knew. I would get calls saying, hey, we don't want this company there. We don't want that company there. But they said, we want Circle Food Store back. This is what we want.
For the community, it was Circle Foods or bust. Dwayne finally received funding from various sources, including state and federal tax credits and $1 million from the city's Fresh Food Retailer Initiative. And now the store is scheduled to open at the end of the month. But I walked the streets off St. Bernard Avenue to hear memories of the store before the flood. People remember it like it was yesterday.
They had the little chickens out. And the little rabbits and the Christmas trees. And the whole place would be like Wonderland to me.
Oh, well, you know, you had the butcher shop, you had your deli and all that, you know, and your produce and all that. And Circle Food Store was known for that, you know, the bell peppers, the Millitone.
I used to go to Circle Food Store every day, 7 days out of a week. Even if I had to go get an onion, a bell pepper. You know, bell pepper used to be like $4 for $1.
Everyone loves the throwback prices, oranges, you know, but it's more than that. The place is described like a holy land by those who've lived in the area all their lives, like Erica Foy.
You can't go nowhere else when the Circle Food Store is right there in the heart of the neighborhood.
Because the store was so embedded in the neighborhood, says Erica's brother Danny Foy, you didn't just shop there, you worked there.
When you got to be a teenager, that's the first place you would go and get a job, you know? You go see the owners, and they know you from the neighborhood coming there, and they, you know, watch you when you was raised, you know?
In hiring employees for the new store, Dwayne Boudreau is taking applications from all over. But he's giving preference to those who live in the neighborhood, and first and foremost, those who worked at Circle before, like Ryan Hamilton.
Duran been trying to get this up since 2006. He just kept on. I think if it was anybody else, it wouldn't have happened, because that's a long time.
Mr. Hamilton was a store manager until he had to look for new work in 2005.
I used to call him at least 20 times a year. What's going on? How it look? Getting there, how it look, getting there every year. Kept calling, it's finally happened.
Many older folks in the neighborhood have struggled to make groceries without a store nearby. Joyce Montana, the wife of Allison Tutti Montana, is 83 years old. She says because stores like Circle didn't come back right away, many people who lacked transportation decided not to move back after the storm.
A lot of buildings is gone astray, like that house over there. They used to, when I first moved around here, they had people living in that house. And it's been sitting like that for maybe about 10 years.
Some also relied on Circle Foods to supply certain items crucial in their cooking. Patricia Richard misses the special brisket that only Circle Foods carried.
I'm tired of traveling all over the city trying to find something because I know once they're open, I can't wait to get me some meat to make me a pot of soup. I have made a pot of soup here since I can't find the meat until Circle opened. I know they're going to have it.
When I asked Dwayne Boudreau what he absolutely had to bring back to the new store, he knew what people wanted.
We were bringing back the seafood that we always did. We were bringing back the wild game, the turtles. That's what we're known for around here that I don't think anybody else are going to do. And I'm out really still trying to search for a few more vendors for my turtles. When we put our new case back here and a couple of the guys in there asked me, oh, what is this case for? And a few people say, well, this is our specialty item. And people start thinking specialty items is special cuts of meat. And I'm saying, no, that's my pigtails and my oxtail and my calf tongues and my different stuff like that that is specialty for this area.
Miss Pat and Miss Joyce can't wait to walk across the street, find their specialty items, and walk them back home. But what it really means for them is seeing the neighborhood come back, seeing people back in the streets, says Miss Joyce.
Most of the people who live in this neighborhood, they've been in this neighborhood practically all their life. If the Circle Food Store opened, it'd give them a chance to walk to the store, and then on the way, they would meet their neighbors, and that would give them a chance to visit with their neighbors and find out what's going on, and it'd give you something to get out and go to.
Circle Foods is the first big redevelopment project on St. Bernard, along with the repaving of the avenue in November of 2013. And the neighborhood was recently zoned as mixed use. That means it now has the same designation as corridors like Ferret and Frenchman Street, where business and residential can mix. Circle Foods hopes to be just the first of many businesses that brings new life to this part of the city. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson.
Grits and groceries, eggs and porters and
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Doesn't every parent think their child is exceptional, gifted perhaps? But how is gifted defined or determined? And does that same definition apply across the socioeconomic spectrum? And once a child is labeled as gifted, then what? Linda Silverman is a psychologist who has studied giftedness in children for more than 35 years. She's written several books on the subject, including Giftedness 101, and is founder and director of the Gifted Development Center and Visual Spatial Resource in Denver, Colorado. Linda, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
At first glance, the term gifted sounds like a pretty broad umbrella. So how do you define a gifted child?
I think the most definitional piece of giftedness is abstract reasoning. While all children are definitely special, all children do not develop abstract reasoning at the same rate or to the same level. So I like to think of giftedness very simply as developmental advancement, and that would be the opposite end of the coin of developmental delay or disability. So there are children we know that develop at a slower rate than others, and we know that in every socioeconomic group, in every culture, we have children who develop at a faster rate.
Well, how do we recognize abstract reasoning? What kind of characteristics would you look for in a child?
The kinds of questions they ask, dead giveaway. You know, while one child is trying to figure out how to whistle, another child is asking about, why was I born? What is the purpose of my life? Who made God? The deep and existential questions.
Why is it so important that we identify gifted children?
Gifted children can be isolated. They can be lonely. They can be depressed or anxious if their reality isn't validated in the world. And they are targets. They tend to be made fun of and teased and bullied because they tend to be more honest and to see more, to be more aware. And they have different social, emotional, intellectual needs. If you have a gifted child who is languishing in the classroom doing the exact same work that everybody else is doing, they're learning daily how to underachieve.
Well, in a classroom, you know, a teacher is facing a number of students, and identifying those who are gifted is a challenge. And one of the things that you do identify as a means of testing is the IQ test. There's been a lot of criticism about IQ tests, however, in the past, about how accurate they are, or especially across socioeconomic divides. But you still rely on them. Why?
I rely on IQ tests because they do tell us with better efficiency than any other test who has this kind of abstract reasoning that we can't see necessarily in a classroom when we're designing curriculum for children who are operating at a much lower level. The IQ test does find, with reliability, children of poor circumstances, children of culturally diverse circumstances. The problem is that we mix up two very different kinds of errors. That is false negatives and false positives. It absolutely is going to miss many kids who have deprivation of one kind or another. Children who had no books in their home, whose parents didn't talk to them. But it will find children that are thinking abstractly, and it does not create false positives. So yes, the IQ test does in fact miss a lot of kids. But the kids it finds, it does not find accidentally. Mm-hmm. And it finds kids in all socioeconomic ranges. And it opens up opportunities for those children that may never have been opened up any other way.
Well, that's the question. The opportunities. Your studies emphasize developing one-on-one relationships with children. But there are a lot of limitations on school systems challenged with educating so many kids, shrinking budgets. Do you think some of these gifted children often fall through the cracks?
They certainly do. And there are some very easy things that schools can do that don't cost a dime. If you recognize that a child is reading at an advanced level or the child is doing advanced mathematics, there is absolutely no point in giving that child the same work that everybody else has. It's possible to allow them to learn with the children in the higher level class. It doesn't cost anything.
We're talking about gifted children, how they are identified and how best to teach them and whether their needs are different than other students. Linda Silverman is with us. She's a psychologist and she's studied giftedness in children over the course of 35 years. Well, gifted is now a term often used for children with special needs. You call this twice exceptional. So kids who are not in the norm in terms of what, social skills? Are you referring to kids with Asperger's, for example, who might be extremely gifted academically but not socially?
That's only one of the exceptionalities. The term gifted usually refers to children who are academically or developmentally advanced. But the term exceptional goes across all exceptionalities and fits children who are intellectually disabled as well as children who are intellectually advanced. And twice exceptional means that a child is gifted but also has a disability. For example, dyslexia. There are a lot of gifted children who can't master reading phonetically. There's a lot of gifted children who have visual processing problems or auditory processing problems or sensory integration issues. They can't stand tags, for example, on their clothes, and they get upset if there's a lot of loud noises around them. So there's a number of different disabilities, just like there would be if we weren't talking about gifted children with disabilities. And a gifted child can have any one of those disabilities, could be in a wheelchair.
You also mentioned characteristics in your books, so like perfectionism, you just said heightened sensitivity, and often conflict or difficulty with some social expectations. Do you think that parents often mistake gifted traits as negative traits, something to be fixed?
Yes, I think they do. And I think the biggest trait that parents have trouble with is the tendency to argue. Gifted children were born to argue. And many parents who came from strict authoritarian backgrounds where respect your elders was is just an expectation in their family have difficulty with children who say, but why? And who aren't going to do what the parents ask them until they're given an explanation. Gifted children are very aware of ageism. They think everybody should be treated with respect, not just people older than themselves. And in the work that I've done, I've called attention to the emotional differences in the gifted, higher sensitivity, getting their feelings hurt more easily, showing compassion and empathy, perfectionism, being intense, being morally sensitive. These are the kinds of things that also are part of the package of being gifted. And a term that we have started using is overexcitability.
Well, I wonder what happens then if these innate qualities are not nurtured, if they are ignored, if, you know, if they become too problematic for parents or teachers to, first of all, diagnose properly and then deal with. What's at stake?
The children's mental health, their ability to use their intelligence in a positive way. We've done some research years ago in a juvenile delinquent population in Colorado and found that more than 15% of the children in the Arapaho juvenile court system were in the top 3 percentile in IQ, according to the testing we did, which means that if we don't harvest and channel these kinds of abilities in a positive way, it's possible that they will become leaders in using their abilities in a negative way. Mm-hmm. It also means that they're very likely to be unhappy and to underachieve, and they can become so despondent at times that we have kids that are at risk for suicide.
Well, Linda Silverman, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Virginia. I appreciate this opportunity.
Linda Silverman is a psychologist and founder and director of the Gifted Development Center and Visual Spatial Resource in Colorado. Her website features a test that can help you determine if a child you know has the characteristics of a gifted child. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. A recent study out of the University of Western Ontario and the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research examined declining birth rates in the developed world and came up with some startling results. Researchers followed 2,000 German participants for several years and found that those people who had children experienced a steep decline in one important category, personal happiness. Here with more is Brett Burke. He's author of A Gay Uncle's Guide to Parenting and a contributor to Vanity Fair, where we found his article, Babies Make You Sad and Other Bleak News for New Parents. Brett, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me back on. I appreciate it.
So babies make you less happy. I'm curious how researchers measure happiness. Is there a scale?
They use a standardized scale. It uses a 1 to 10 measurement. And because having a child, being a new parent, is a sensitive kind of subject, they don't ask specifically about, you know, how happy are you about having a new child? Because people are averse to saying, I hate having a new child, for rather obvious reasons, because I think they think of kids as being sort of defenseless and that it's, you know, their own choice that they had the child, so they probably don't want to blame themselves. So they just ask about general happiness and satisfaction, what the sociologists call well-being.
And this is just for new parents, correct?
Yes. This particular study looked at people from prior to the birth of their first child until 2 years or more after the birth of their first child. And it was really intended to sort of look at why are birth rates declining in the developed world and to see if there was some sort of correlation, I guess we should say, between people's sense of satisfaction and well-being and whether or not they might go on and have another child.
Well, this was among Germans. Is the same true for Americans or other Europeans?
I think there's been a number of different studies in recent years that have sort of shown similar kinds of things, that the first few years after you have a child are relatively miserable ones. I don't have any children of my own, but I've been working with kids for 20-something years, especially young kids. I'm an early childhood educator by training. And, you know, you can sort of see some of the bleakness that goes into people's lives when they lose their sense of self, they lose sleep, they lose sort of financial stability, they lose an idea of identity of who they were, there's strain on relationships, There's strain on friendships. There's strain on familial connection. So you could sort of see how that might have a negative impact on people during those first few years of life. So there's been a number of studies that have demonstrated that. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be miserable about having children forever.
Well, the study did find an average decline of 1.4 on the happiness scale for those participants who had children. In your article, you explain that though the 1.4 number seems low in relation to other pretty tragic life events, it's actually pretty significant. Explain what you mean.
Yeah, so they say getting divorced causes a drop of just 0.6 units on the scale,
mm-hmm.
And that losing a job or having your partner or spouse die causes a drop of just 1 unit. So 1.4 is very, very significant.
That's like losing your partner and your job on the same day.
Yeah, sort of like that, something like that.
How about demographic-wise? Are some parents more likely to be unhappy after having a child than others?
Sure, sorry to interrupt. The study showed, overall, about two-thirds of people showed a decline, and the average decline was 1.4. It was significantly higher for older parents and for those who were highly educated. And there's thoughts about why that might be. It could be that people who are older had, a longer period of time in which to develop their adult identity and weren't ready to lose it, or were surprised by how much of a change being a parent caused. If you're highly educated or a high achiever, this could be another significant life change that you weren't quite prepared for, or that you didn't know how to cope with.
Well, plenty of people do end up having multiple children, certainly more than the two-thirds who had responded that their overall well-being has significantly declined after having a child. So do people just not realize that it is having children that makes them miserable?
I think, we're conditioned to sort of think of babies as bundles of joy. And if you have a biological child, it looks like you, and it acts like you, and it takes on your attributes. So, it's sort of a evolutionary tool so that you're not fighting it for food and you don't hate it. But I think that, there is a required sort of blindness when you're becoming a parent, because there is a lot of misery. And when you talk to people about having kids, they generally say like, oh my God, it was the greatest torture that ever happened to me in my entire life those first few years, but I wouldn't give it up for the world.
Mm.
So people always say, no one ever told me it was going to be this difficult, which, if they read my book, they would know that, but not everyone has read my book, sadly.
Brett Berg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Brett Berg, he's a longtime educator and author of The Gay Uncle's Guide to Parenting and a regular contributor to Vanity Fair. And that's where we found his article, Babies Make You Sad and Other Bleak News for New Parents. You'll find a link to read it for yourself. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sail north along the eastern Canadian shore and you'll reach the island of Newfoundland. It's a place with a deep and rich musical heritage and rugged beauty, and a place where stories of survival and songs of the sea have been handed down through the generations. Matthew Byrne is one of a crop of younger musicians keeping that traditional music alive. Producer Fiona Shea brings us the story.
Matthew Byrne steps on stage in Bannerman Park, rubs his hands together against the cold, and begins to sing.
Come all ye lads, fair young maids, come all.
This is a song culture, where people can and do learn about Newfoundland through the music, about shipwrecks, confederation, horses falling through ice, about the bitter northwesterly wind off the ocean keenly felt on this August night. The concert was part of the 39th annual Newfoundland and Labrador Folk Festival in Newfoundland's capital, St. John's. After the show, I sat down to talk with Matthew Byrne in true folk musician fashion in a noisy pub tucked down a narrow alleyway, the Duke of Duckworth.
There's the traditional music, the mallets, the sea songs, the shanties, the story songs, all of those things that made their way to Newfoundland from the places from which the people came, England and Ireland and Scotland, I guess a more new kind of take on it would be the music that has been written kind of by Newfoundlanders about Newfoundland, about the Newfoundland experience, about living off the sea or whatever it is.
Jim Harris in the Ronald P. from St. Karen sailed away. He sailed away.
folk festival is put on by the Newfoundland and Labrador Folk Arts Society, where John Clark is the events coordinator. He's a huge advocate of getting kids playing traditional music, especially on the Neil Murray stage, a folk festival stage devoted to young performers.
It's really great to see people progress, you know, from small children playing the most basic kind of stuff and all the, you know, the generic songbook to coming into their own, you know, writing their own tunes or really reinterpreting solid traditional music with real honesty and depth.
Matthew is one of several young musicians who came up on the Neil Murray stage and have since gone on to headline the festival here in St. John's and festivals and stages across the world. In many forms of traditional music, there are songs with lyrics, stories, and reoccurring symbols, and then there are tunes, the music and sound that gets to the heart of traditional culture. As well as playing solo, Matthew Byrne plays with the Dardanelles, one of Newfoundland's most rollicking traditional bands. The Dards, as they're known, focus more on the tunes themselves, seeking to reinvent the way audiences think about traditional music.
The music, as it was always played, it does have, you know, a lot of fire. And I think, you know, we just happen to be a band who, that's obvious when you see us, I think. I hope it is.
Whether they do it as a career or just because it's what they do, they're doing it. Musicians like Matthew, the rest of the Dards, as well as folks like Fergus O'Byrne, Jim Payne, Anita Best, and Kelly Russell are preserving the music simply by playing it. For Matthew, it isn't about preservation.
Years ago, like the dance tunes in Newfoundland, I mean, the people who got together for square dances or who got together and sat around and exchanged songs and had a session in the kitchen or whatever, they weren't thinking it was important. They weren't thinking that it was like, oh, this is our duty to preserve it. They were just getting together and playing the music that they liked most.
Now we are ready to head for the horse.
Come away, hey, roll and go.
And our clothes, boys, are all in the pond.
Dandy, Rollick, and Randy, Dandy,
oh. I do it because I really like the music and I really like the stories and the history, and every song and every tune has people and places behind it. I'm learning things about people, specifically people in my family who I never knew otherwise, who I never would have known otherwise, you know, grandparents and great-grandparents. It's been a window into all of those people. I've learned a little bit about who they are, because when a song comes from them, then you find out about them.
When blinding storm gusts fret thy shore and wild waves...
It may be August, but the wind off the ocean is cold. The performers packed together on stage hardly notice. Matthew and Fergus, Jim and Anita, and other festival performers bellow the aptly named and well-loved Ode to Newfoundland as the festival comes to a close. This is a place of big hearts and grand heroes. The harbor tonight is quiet and brightly lit. And just for a moment, the rain has let up.
As loved our father, so we love.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Fiona Shea.
And throughout the next month, the traditional sounds of Newfoundland will be coming to New England. You can hear Anita Best at McClary Hill Farm in Epsom, New Hampshire, on August 27th. Matthew Byrne and the Dards will be playing at the American Folk Festival in Bangor, Maine, also at the end of the month. And Alan Doyle will be performing at Concord's Capital Center for the Arts on September 27th. There's more information on those shows at wordofmouthradio.org. And a special thanks to our fiddle-playing intern, Fiona Shea, who produced that story. Today is her last day with Word of Mouth. Besides being an accomplished musician, Fiona is a thoughtful writer and a sharp, critical thinker. And we hope she'll be injecting her own youthful energy into making sound and idea-rich radio. Thank you, Fiona. Or as they say in Newfoundland, God love you, me old trout. And with that, we're out of time, and thank you for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. There you can also sign up for the Word of Mouth podcast and never miss a beat. You can also find it by searching for Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please pass it around or write a review. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.